Sounds True presents Tape 5 of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry with Jack Kornfield.
Honoring Family Karma. A prophet is never heeded in his own country and in his own home, said Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. And Margaret Mead puts it, no matter how many communes and communities they make, the family will always come back. It's one thing to offer a multitude of prayers for the sick and the poor, or to undertake loving kindness and compassion meditation for thousands of sentient beings everywhere. It is another to bring these same practices to our own family and our closest community. Even the Buddha and Jesus encountered difficulties when they went back home after starting to preach. Jesus' ministry was dismissed without respect by his family. Then, when his mother and brothers came to the house where he was preaching, Jesus refused to let them in, pointing to his disciples and saying, "These are my true mother and brothers, those who do the will of God." Similarly, when the Buddha returned home after his enlightenment, he was rebuked by his father for being an unseemly beggar. His father and stepmother demanded that he stop being a monk, change his clothes, return to his princely duties. When the Buddha tried to teach his family, they dismissed his understanding as worthless. He had to perform a miracle, floating in the air while spouting both fire and water, to convince them that he had learned anything of value. Like Jesus, Zen Master Basho warns, you can't teach the truth in your native town. They only know you by your childhood names. As it happens, this may be the best reason to go home. Where better to fulfill a genuine practice of the heart, the mandala of the whole, than with one's family and neighbors? Because they see us unclouded by spiritual ideals, by image or reputation, they become the true testing ground of our practice. My daughter Caroline has remarked to me more than once when I've been angry or careless or eating sloppily, upset, "Dad, I thought you'd teach mindfulness," or, "Dad, look at what you're doing. What kind of meditation teacher are you?" Sometimes, when I'm having a hard time, she simply says, "Dad, I think it's time for you to go and meditate." As one Zen master puts it, the role of a spiritual teacher can imprison us in the very task of enlightened helper. Bringing wisdom and compassion to others, we can lose our common human relations. Most of the people we know are in the role of students. We run the risk of isolation, of becoming a kind of sacred monster, without the counterweight of ordinary human connection, family, friends, and real relationships. Family provides this best of all. One devotee laughingly stated of her husband, a well-known Hindu teacher, "My husband came home from his last visit in India in an amazing state. He was enlightened for 6 months until he spent time with his mother." Another respected teacher of Raja Yoga used to emphasize what her guru taught her, "You are not the body, you are not the mind." She taught these truths and wrote about them for many years. As she aged, she was determined not to be dependent on anyone. After having a series of strokes, she called her children together, reminded them, "I am not the body," and with their help, took a large dose of morphine to end her life. Days later, she awoke from a coma in the hospital, and when she returned home, her family was understandably in great disarray. Not only had participating in the attempted suicide been a terribly hard trial, but the experiences had brought up other long-held resentments. Her teaching of "you are not the body and mind" had made her a rather poor mother in many ways over the years. She spent her last year making amends and learning to tend to her family and allowing them to tend her. Family pain is common throughout our culture, and spiritual communities often draw those with a painful family history. Spiritual seekers may come for release, to heal, or to find a way to transcend the troubles they carry within. This is not true of students alone. Most Western spiritual leaders, meditation teachers, monks, nuns, and clergy also carry deep family wounds. They, too, may have initially hoped that spiritual detachment and peace would release them from dealing with family pain. But one Chinese Chan master cautions, "Don't confuse non-attachment and freedom with running away. Your idea of leaving your family and children to renounce the world is like running from your shadow. This is false emptiness. There's nowhere you can go that is any more or less empty than your own house. Enlightenment has been here from the start." We cannot escape the fact of our family background and the wounds it inflicts. Nor can we impose our spiritual ideals on our family. One young woman who had become very involved in Buddhist practice returned to her parents' home. She struggled with their Christian fundamentalism for a long time until she sorted things out. Then she sent a letter back to the monastery stating, "My parents hate me when I'm a Buddhist, but they love me when I'm a Buddha." This is our task, to awaken the Buddha in facing our family karma. When my father was dying of congestive heart failure, I went to be with him in the ICU of the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. Because he was a biophysicist and had taught in medical schools, he was keenly aware of all the equipment monitoring his heart. He was terrified of dying, and especially of dying in his sleep without the nurses knowing it, so he dared not let himself sleep. He would fall asleep for 3 minutes and then startle awake and anxiously turn to the monitor to see if his heart was still working. This went on night after night. Though brilliant, my father had also been violent-tempered and physically abusive. For everyone around him, he was a paranoid and difficult man. Now, without sleep for days, he was even more out of control. Still, over the years, I had made my peace with him, and I loved him. I sat with him and we talked. As he was very anxious and distracted, I tried to teach him meditation. We practiced breath awareness for calmness and tried a loving-kindness meditation with his grandchildren as the focus. It was useless. 15 minutes of practicing meditation could not undo 75 years of practicing paranoia. When I asked what he thought happens when you die, he answered, "Nothing." As a scientist, he didn't believe in anything beyond the physical. Death was the end. I noted that the majority of the world believes in life after death, which is also validated by near-death research. I told him about my own out-of-the-body, past life experiences, and even explained the stages of dying and what he might possibly experience. He was doubtful. "Just wait, you'll be surprised," I said, and I added, "If it does happen, remember, I told you so." He laughed. Later in the evening, most visitors had gone, and I told my father I needed to sleep. "Don't go," he pleaded. I sat with him for another hour, as he repeatedly drifted into sleep and fearfully startled awake. "I can't sleep. Please, please don't go." I was happy to comply. I've learned to sit. 11, 12, 1, 2 a.m., I sat with him over a number of nights. There wasn't much to say. I held his hand. He was frightened. He didn't want to know about meditation. He didn't even want to talk much. What mattered was that I sat there, not being afraid, not rejecting his fear and his pain, simply holding his hand. He died after several more days. I was grateful to have been able to sit with him during this extraordinary time. Perhaps this is the best we can do, to help when we can, to witness each other with kindness, to offer our presence, to show the trust we have in life. Spiritual life is not about knowing much, but about loving much. Most of us in spiritual life have to go through a large measure of family healing. To finally be able to sit at ease with my father was the result of many years of conscious work. My family pain had been covered over in my early monastic meditation, while I focused on being empty, peaceful, and wise. But it was there, underneath, waiting, unconsciously influencing my whole way of being. And when I returned to family and to intimate relations, the struggles all came back. It may well be that even if I had stayed in ascetic practice, they would have eventually returned. To find myself still struggling with my emotions was hard. I needed the assistance of both meditation and therapy before I could acknowledge the deepest levels of fear, anger, judgment, and grief that I carried. The therapist was essential as a compassionate witness, another being to help me face the images and fears I carried in my body, everything I'd not been able to face alone. I saw how much the old patterns had reinforced my small sense of self. In the face of pain in our family, my brothers and I had each become regularly depressed or angry, fearful, cynical, needy, or cautious. These deep wounds remain part of each of us to this day, but by opening to them, we began to lessen their power. In the mandala of wholeness, our difficulties, including these generational problems, are carried until the pain of the past can be transformed. In his death poem, Lama Chogyam Trungpa wrote about the value of the teachings he had offered to his students and then reminded them, "I will be haunting you." Our family's patterns can likewise remain to haunt us even after years of spiritual practice. We may carry dependency, fear, self-criticism, unworthiness, anger, or depression as a family legacy. These early wounds need healing, whether in a therapeutic relationship or through the growing wisdom of our spiritual path. We need to find the freedom of our own spirit and discover that our family history is not who we are. Tolerance gives birth to intimacy. Traditional teachings focus so often on love and its transformative spirit that we can overlook a more basic and fundamental power, the tolerant heart. After the ecstasy of spiritual awakening, there is the day-to-day fulfillment in the laundry room of our sustained practice. One natural outcome of an awakening experience that sustains us during this time is an increase in our spirit of tolerance, in accepting what is. In this renewed and capacious tolerance, the heart's harmony can be found. Human differences are enormous. Our rhythms, what our bodies are like, our aesthetic sense, our emotions, our fears, the way we move, speak, love, or rest. There are vast differences of race, culture, class, and values. Without tolerance, there is no ground for a relationship, no possibility of intimacy. Without tolerance, family life can be unbearable. Temperament and personality all differ dramatically. Without tolerance, we would have a society of perpetual conflict, a world of sectarianism and tribalism, of warfare and genocide. We don't have to like, let alone love, those we tolerate. The truth is that even spiritual teachers do not always like one another, nor do they necessarily get along. Many respected Zen masters and swamis, ajahns and sheikhs, lamas and rabbis have powerful disagreements. Some have a distaste for one another's teachings or style. Yet the wise among them embody a genuine tolerance, knowing that another person's reasons may be invisible to us, that another person's way is as worthy of respect as our own. Tolerance does not mean acceptance of what is harmful. Just as detachment and numbing can be spiritually misused to hide from our feelings, so tolerance can be misused if we avoid seeing the truth or fail to take a necessary stand. Tolerance does not mean turning a blind eye to abuse. To prevent further suffering, we may need to respond with great strength. But when our heart is connected with our actions, even this strength can be combined with compassion, understanding. I saw this in the way Ajahn Chah handled the abbot of a branch monastery, a man named Ajahn Som, who'd been a street tough and petty thug before he ordained. Even as abbot, he had a reputation of being harsh and difficult, and monks who returned from his temple often complained about him. One day I demanded of Ajahn Chah why someone like him was allowed to remain as an abbot. Ajahn Chah paused thoughtfully and said, although he was a difficult fellow, this Ajahn Som had founded a cave monastery through years of labor with his own hands in a remote, pristine forest. His spiritual dedication was slowly growing. And it's true, he might never be a picture book monk, but if Ajahn Chah were to take away his monastery, he'd probably go back out on the street. Is that what I was recommending? We so easily become judgmental of one another. Sometimes the closer we are to a person, the stronger our judgments and frustrations can become. That is why family is one of the final frontiers of spiritual development. One former Hindu Swami told me, after my years of yoga in India, I came back to teach and marry. Later, I became head of a temple. My samadhi experiences showed me the bliss of all things. Over time, I got busy, and I started to lose it, to tell you the truth. I tried to meditate more to get it back. We had conflict in the temple, and in my marriage we fought, sometimes quite terribly. Some days I wondered if I should ever try to practice in this worldly life. Even meditation was not giving me much help. One day I was visiting my family and taking care of my young nephew. It was a hard day for the Swami and the 3-year-old. We messed up the house, he threw a tantrum. Finally, I took him in my arms and just held him. I sang Sanskrit melodies, and I realized that's all the world wants, to be held in spite of it all. The bliss and samadhi came back as soon as I opened my heart. The birth of tolerance and acceptance is most truly one close to home. In my own home, my wife and I are temperamental opposites, and we each come from difficult family backgrounds. She's quiet, an artist and writer, with a deep need for solitude, stillness, and interior life. I, though a meditator, am more extroverted, with a huge network of Dharma friends, colleagues, and community members. In our first years, I dreamed about getting a large house in the country with lots of rooms for visiting friends. She, of course, had something smaller in mind. When I protested, she asked, "Didn't you just spend 10 years living in a meditation center in the country with a big library and kitchen? If that's what you want, why don't you just go back to your retreat center?" With a lot of care and some good therapy, we made it through our stormy beginnings, got married, had a beautiful child. Still, some of our differences continued. One day, we were walking through a Zen center garden with our baby daughter. Liana had recently given me Jean Shinoda Bolen's book, The Goddesses in Every Woman, after reading it herself, so that we could talk about the different aspects of feminine energy and the parenting of a girl. I told her I enjoyed it, especially the chapters that describe the strength of Artemis women and the grace and beauty of Aphrodite. Then I added there was one goddess I didn't particularly connect with, Hestia, who has no temple. She's the goddess of hearth and home, ever present but invisible. When I said that, Liana looked at me stunned, threw the book on the ground and broke into tears. "That's me. That goddess describes my life. I knew you never really loved me. I knew it." And she turned and strode away. It took a few minutes to feel the force of her words, to collect myself and turn back to her. Shocked by the truth in what she said and by a flood of realizations, I could only reply, "You know, my dear, I'm sorry to say you're right. I do love you, but without knowing it, somehow, I was still hoping that you would be different." For so long, I had kept an unconscious hope, an idea of how she would change for me. And of course, she felt it. It was only after being forced to see her reality instead of my own desires that I grew to love her for who she is. Together, we created a home for Hestia, and now I go out to work with big groups and return home to a quiet and simple family life. And I've come to be nourished and protected by my family and to love it as it is and praise my wife's wisdom every day. Family is a mirror. In our spouses, our lovers, our parents, and children, we find our needs and hopes and fears writ large. Intimate relations reach in and touch our history without anesthesia. The wounds we carry, the longings we have to be nourished, are right on the table. They need to be respected. That is why, even in our own families, to say that we love one another underneath it all is not enough. We also need to be tolerant and respectful of one another. We extend the same large-hearted spirit to the members of our family that we practice in prayer or in the non-judging awareness of our inner state. Tolerance and blamelessness grow when we see the remarkable and strange qualities in each of the lives we touch. Every person is singular and unique, expressing his or her own nature. Even those who are difficult are living the best they know how. Respectful parenting. Such honorable appreciation between adults is also the basis for wise child-rearing. Another word for this tolerance is respect. This is found in the story of a 7-year-old boy who went out to dinner with his parents and their friends. The waitress took his order last. "What would you like?" she asked. "I'd like a hot dog and French fries," he answered. His mother quickly interjected, "He'll have the meatloaf, mashed potatoes, and carrots with milk to drink." As the waitress walked away, she asked, "Do you want ketchup or mustard on your hot dog?" The boy turned to the table smiling and announced, "Do you know what? She thinks I'm real." Our children love respect. Even little ones want respect for their needs and respect for their fears. Our lovers, our parents, our coworkers, the animals and trees around us blossom with our respect. Offering respect is the foundation of parenting as a spiritual practice. Without awareness and respect, we simply repeat what was done to us, acting in ways conditioned by our own upbringing. Without respect, we will continue whatever cycles of wounding, shame, unworthiness, stress, or abandonment existed in our own past. Without a spiritual perspective, our heart's natural caring in parenting can be overpowered by the speed and materialism of modern life, by the pervasive values of the media, by the accepted norms of stress and violence. Without a respectful attention, we allow the media and modern pressures to hurry our children to grow, forgetting to protect their dependency and vulnerability. We forget to trust that children naturally become independent in their own sweet time. Without attention to our hearts, we become like the generation of parents who followed popular experts in refusing to pick up or feed crying children, even though every wise instinct and cellular impulse in their body called for them to hold and comfort their child in pain. With respect, we can offer our children protection and wholehearted nurturance, while at the same time setting appropriate limits on their behavior. Our spiritual teaching will be conveyed not just in our words, but in the integrity of our daily life, how we demonstrate the respect and the deepest values of our heart. It's never too late to offer this respect. When we become adults, we can carry this respect back to our family. A woman who had trained as a Buddhist nun in the monasteries of Thailand and Burma spoke to me of her difficulties upon returning to visit her home. Her family lived in Detroit, in a working-class neighborhood. She had let go of much of the pain in her family's past, but even now they did not understand or accept her as a shaven-headed nun. And however hard she tried to teach them about meditation and Dharma, It only led to conflict and more frustration. The family evenings were usually given to drinking beer and watching TV. After each disagreeable week-long visit home, she fled. I had a few suggestions for her. Why don't you try going to your parents without your robes and no teaching? Just be there as a family member and love them as they are. Maybe sit with them and sip a beer and watch the games on TV. Oh yes, and don't stay too long, 3 days at most. So she tried it. Next time I saw her, she was smiling. It had worked. Thomas Merton described this kind of tolerance for others as learning to see the secret beauty of their hearts beneath all our expectations in regards to them. When we see the secret beauty of others' hearts, we connect from our true nature. We see the sacred spark that illuminates our life and theirs as well. You will be tested. In the commandments of the great Middle Eastern religions, Jewish, Christian, and Islamic, it is taught you must honor your mother and father. In Indian and Chinese traditions, these teachings can be even stronger. If you were to carry your parents on your back, says one text, you could hardly repay them for giving you life. Whatever your tradition, this obligation remains, and its fulfillment is not necessarily simple. Aging parents, unhappy teens, conflict with siblings, money problems, family illness, addictions, all are part of accepting family life as an ongoing practice. These difficulties become even more burdensome in a society like ours without much community, where aged people are shunted to old age homes, and where teens, isolated from their elders, often seek initiation in destructive ways. Underneath all these problems is the essential human need to be connected. Someone once said, "It is better to be wanted by the police than not to be wanted at all." For better or worse, family is the original source of this connection, offering both love and responsibility. Family responsibilities never end. Many of us will find ourselves caring for parents through the slow decline of Alzheimer's, cancer, or stroke. Many others will be involved with difficult teens or family depression, or tending to marital conflicts or the divorces of our siblings, our children, ourselves. The sacrifices of a family are like those of any demanding monastery, offering exactly the same trainings in renunciation, patience, steadiness, and generosity. Thus, when one middle-aged monk told me that monks had to self-discipline and sacrifice, while a layman's life was by nature one of indulgence, I laughed. He went on, "Oh, you can eat when you want, dress as you choose, party, enjoy a succession of lovers, live a carefree life." I wondered whose lay life he was describing. Further conversation revealed that he had ordained at age 21, so his vision of lay life was left over from his own teenage years. He didn't understand that marriage, work, parenting, citizenship are their own forms of discipline. The demands of family life call on our hearts and test our strength like almost nothing else. One teacher told me, "As a young Catholic, I was inspired by the saints. I had always wanted to do things like work with Mother Teresa in India, but most of my life has not been so glamorous. After college, I became a teacher in an elementary school. And then my mother had a stroke, and I had to drop out of teaching, help her for 2 years, bathe her, care for her bed sores, cook, pay the bills, run the house. At times, I wanted to complete these responsibilities and get back to my spiritual life. And then one morning it dawned on me, I was doing the work of Mother Teresa, and I was doing it in my own home." At home or in the temple, it is the same. In one ancient account, the Buddha found one of his monks sick and uncared for because the other monks were busy with their meditations. The Buddha himself washed and tended the monk, and then called the entire community membership together to castigate and instruct them. If you do not care for each other as family, who else will do so? Monks, those who would attend to the Buddha, let them attend to the sick. 500 years later, Jesus said to his disciples, "In truth I tell you, insofar as you did this to one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did it to me." This is the love that knows we are one family, and all later loves in our life will stem from this. The essence of family connection cannot be lost. Do not doubt its power. It is this love of parents and children, brothers and sisters, that brings the most amazing stories. The mother who miraculously lifts a car off her child's body. The disabled father who throws himself, wheelchair and all, into the swimming pool to hang on to the side for hours in order to save his toddler son from drowning. In Argentina, the terrible military dictatorship of the 1970s tortured, killed, and disappeared tens of thousands of suspected opponents. Sebastian Rotella describes how desperate mothers began to protest in spite of the dangers, becoming famous as the Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo. 20 years ago, the mothers went to the plaza in front of the presidential palace and confronted the bureaucracy of horror. The mothers were fed up with futile visits to military chaplains who wore army boots under their robes, and to the complaint office where the dictatorship denied inquiries about people whom for years it was systematically kidnapping, torturing, and killing. When the women congregated at the plaza, police snapped at them to keep moving. So the 14 mothers walked the plaza in slow circles. They kept coming back to protest, braving nightsticks, police dogs, and military spies who infiltrated the group and killed 3 leaders. They say the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo were fearless, said Maria Adela Antokletz, now 85, who moves with slow, tottering steps and enormous dignity. But we were scared to death. We learned to walk with fear, to live with fear, for we had an obligation to find our children. The ritual moves bystanders to tears and applause. The women are elderly and fragile now. They walk arm in arm, hunched beneath the white headscarves that have become an international symbol of the fight for human rights. "We never found our children," she said, "but in the plaza we went to school. We told our story 50 times. We cried together. It was our educational academy. The plaza saved us from the madhouse." At 3:25, the plaza would be as empty as a desert, and 5 minutes later, the mothers would appear like plants growing out of the subway station, the side streets. The people would come up and ask, "Who are you? Teachers? Pensioners? What are you protesting?" It spread by word of mouth. And when Cortazar, our great writer, heard about it in Paris, he said, "The mothers are out. The military have already lost." Stretching the heart's mercy. Facing the suffering in our family and community brings us a great task: to stay true to our deepest values and still remain open and vulnerable. Whatever hardens and closes our heart leaves us rigid, frightened, unresponsive. Through our grudges and fears, we become increasingly territorial and defensive. How can we keep the heart open without losing our strength and our sense of justice? To do this, we must allow the heart to become strong in a new way. We turn toward the suffering of the world willingly and let it stretch our compassion. In the inevitable pains, conflicts, and betrayal, we discover we can embrace the power of love. In the midst of difficulty, we can repeatedly stop and return to our heart, reconnect to our strength of compassion and our vulnerability. One Sufi teacher says this of his prayer and meditation: "My main practice is stopping and listening to the heart. It's like a moment of Quaker silence. Even if I can't stand still, I stop inside, step out of the drama, recognize the pain, the busyness, the being lost. I breathe and return. With my family or students, I try to come back to my own heart before speaking, to hold or acknowledge what's needing attention in me. Then I include them in that space of heart. This makes a strong presence, a true connection." When times are tough, and we can't do this alone, we may need another person to help us return to this truth. This is the basis for true spiritual friendship and for fine therapy. One Zen master tells how he needed this in his first year of teaching. He had practiced for 30 years when he received formal transmission as a Roshi. Months later, he found himself becoming painfully lost and insecure, as he had been years earlier in his practice. "I went desperately to a senior Zen master in my lineage. I was afraid he would condemn my insecurity. Instead, he took me in and loved me and expressed total confidence in me. He helped me hold my suffering and confusion with steadiness and faith. My mind relaxed and my teaching was transformed." When we are confused or in pain, we often judge ourselves as not spiritual enough. But the awakened heart does not judge anything, not our family or our love, nor our pain and confusion, our passion or anger. "Terrible harm has been done by this misunderstanding," said one Catholic monk. He went on, "In mature spirituality, we are willing to have a dialogue with pain, with evil, to hold them in our prayers. In situations of great pain, someone has to consciously suffer the impact to become the ground where the sorrows can be held and reworked. These things can be carried with grace, but it can't be faked. If you go to someone with 99% goodwill and are still caught in 1% anger, all they feel is the anger, and it pushes them from reconciliation. The heart has to willingly hold the whole of suffering for it to be transformed." In Zen, holding the suffering sometimes takes the form of eating the blame. It is illustrated by the story of a cook who made soup for the monks from a turtle offered by fishermen that morning. When the soup was ladled into the monks' bowls, the Roshi bellowed for the cook to come out. The turtle's head, which should have been removed before serving, was floating in the master's bowl. The cook bowed to the master, looked into the bowl, saw the problem, and with a deft movement of chopsticks, plucked the turtle head out and ate it. Then he bowed to the master, and the master bowed back, and the cook returned to the kitchen. Eating the blame requires both strength and compassion. It is like the divorcing parent who, in the midst of messy litigation, consciously gives away more than what is legally required so as to spare his children the damage and suffering a protracted court battle would bring. "Even if it's unfair, I want this suffering to stop with me," said one father. "Let me sacrifice now so that it will not be passed on to my children." The truth is that in spiritual life, our awareness of suffering actually increases over the years. We see and know more deeply the sorrows of the world. We can no longer hide from their occurrence, and with this knowledge comes a deepening compassion. No matter how extreme the circumstances, compassion is possible. Once, on the train from Washington to Philadelphia, I found myself seated next to an African-American man who'd worked for the State Department in India, but had quit to run a rehabilitation program for juvenile offenders in the District of Columbia. Most of the youths he worked with were gang members who had committed homicide. One 14-year-old boy in his program had shot and killed an innocent teenager to prove himself to his gang. At the trial, the victim's mother sat impassively silent until the end, when the youth was convicted of the killing. After the verdict was announced, she stood up slowly, stared directly at him, and stated, "I'm gonna kill you." Then the youth was taken away to serve several years in the juvenile facility. After the first half year, the mother of the slain child went to visit his killer. He'd been living on the streets before the killing, and she was the only visitor he'd had. For a time they talked, and when she left, she gave him some money for cigarettes. Then she started, step by step, to visit him more regularly, bringing food and small gifts. Near the end of his 3-year sentence, she asked him what he would do when he got out. He was confused and uncertain, so she offered to help set him up with a job at a friend's company. Then she inquired about where he would live, and since he had no family to return to, she offered him temporary use of the spare room in her home. For 8 months he lived there, ate her food, and worked at the job. Then one evening, she called him into the living room to talk. She sat down opposite him and waited, and then she started. "Do you remember in the courtroom when I said I was going to kill you?" "I sure do," he replied. "I'll never forget that moment." "Well, I did," she went on. "I did not want the boy who could kill my son for no reason to remain alive on this earth. I wanted him to die, and that's why I started to visit you and started to bring you things. That's why I got you the job and let you live here in my house. And that's how I set about changing you. And that old boy, he's gone. So now I want to ask you, since my son is gone and that killer is gone, if you'll stay here. I've got a room and I'd like to adopt you if you'd let me." And she became the mother of her son's killer, the mother he never had. Forgiveness and kind intention. This story brings us back to Nachiketa's journey and the forgiveness he begged for as his first boon from the Lord of Death. In the mandala of wholeness, we are called to the practice of forgiveness. We must especially find a forgiving heart with family and those close to us. Only then can we bring it to the world. Whether we practice through Buddhist meditation, or as Jesus taught, by turning the other cheek, or by finding the mercy of Allah, we must learn to forgive ourselves and others. Booker T. Washington said it simply, "Don't ever let them pull you down so low as to hate them." Forgiveness is the heart's capacity to release its grasp on the pains of the past and free itself to go on. There is so much to learn about letting go and loving. Family becomes the ground for this wisdom to flower. I've heard countless grateful stories of a family member saying, "I finally called my mother and told her I loved her before she died," or, "After all these years of pain, I finally reconciled with my brother." Forgiveness offers the heart's mercy that our hurt and fear have withheld for so long. It is in tenderness and tolerance that our path is made whole. It is in reconciliation and love of those closest to us that the spirit of our human family grows to widen and fully embrace our true family, all that lives. We awaken as part of one another's family. Ishi in Two Worlds, the book, is a remarkable account of the last remaining Yana Indian of California, who was befriended by the anthropologist Theodora and Alfred Kroeber. Ishi tells stories of the way of life of his people, never more to be seen on this earth. Yet one of the most moving stories was not told in that book. Among all the teaching songs and exquisite knowledge of nature revealed by Ishi to the Krobers, there was a sacred song that he had been sworn never to teach to anyone outside the tribe. It was the song sung to the dying, used to sing his people back to their families, to their ancestral lands after death. No one else was allowed to know how to go there. Yet Ishi was alone at the end of his life, the last member of his tribe. It was then that he finally had to teach this last secret to the Krobers so that they would sing him back to his people. In the end, no matter how isolated or embattled our lives, we need one another as family. We need each other's hearts and songs to help one another find the way. Many brothers and sisters, the gifts of community. From the Buddha, the jewel of community of the Sangha is to be held equal to the Buddha and the Dharma. Indeed, the whole of holy life is fulfilled through spiritual friendship. And Thomas Merton, who says, "Saints are what they are not because of their sanctity, but because the gift of sainthood makes it possible for them to admire everyone else." And Rumi says, "You say you can't create something original? Don't worry about it. Make a cup of clay so your brothers can drink." The stories of Jesus and Buddha, of shamans and sages, may initially emphasize their solitary quest, alone in the desert or forest, seeking a holy understanding of our human dilemma. But then the stories go on. Whoever steps beyond individual self and connects with eternity is naturally drawn back to community. This is how we express the heart's realization by bringing it to maturity with others.